Rob Wolf, Andy D's back with episode 54, The Paleo Solution. What's going on today, brother?
You know, the sun's out in Chico, and I'm happy. The sun was not out yesterday, and I wanted to do a Kurt Cobain.
Well, you know, just so people know, this is day three of Andy kicking the caffeine habit again.
Ooh.
Feeling much better today. Yesterday, I felt like I was walking underwater. But if I appear a bit loopy or off, that is why. No clients have asked me this time if I'm drunk while coaching because I'm so out of it. But you know, there's always this evening to see where we are with that.
See when the energy systems really fail. So that'll be fun.
Stop moving paper.
Okay. Yep. When I did my caffeine withdrawal the very first time, I was having auditory and kind of multi-sensory hallucinations. So that was good stuff.
Well, you know, I'm going to blame this last one on you, Rob, because, you know, we had a long weekend at work. We had the strength challenge in Oroville at level 10 CrossFit, which was excellent. And then we had the Almond Bowl in Chico, 10K, 5K. And the weather was horrible, so we didn't go and have our booth. So I had to go to the Rob Wolf book signing. And I had two double cappuccinos with steamed heavy cream. And the addition of the heavy cream pretty much put me over the edge.
Yeah, I suspect that the heavy cream doubles the caffeine uptake, so yeah, I believe it.
So right there at about 2 p.m., I was like, I'm so tired and I've had so much caffeine, I'm like, tomorrow I'm just going to stop for a while again and start over.
Yes, and Andy looks happy, but we'll keep you on the straight and narrow. So.
All right, well, we have some doozy of a question today, and first we're going to start with Matt from Centerville CrossFit for two reasons. One, because I'm from Centerville where this CrossFit is. And actually, the CrossFit's not in Centerville. It's in Washington Township, but they just say it's Centerville. And it's about the Twinkie stunt, which I'm so tired of hearing about, Rob. So I'm going to read this little bit to you, and then I want to hear your take on the Twinkie diet. Because if you're on board, I'm going to start tomorrow.
Sure. we'll get a ream of Twinkies from Costco for the gym.
All right, Matt says, Rob, would love to hear your take from you and your squad on Professor Hobbs' Twinkie stunt. I'm getting a ton of questions from some of my I think they're too smart, don't want to change, and like to throw stones clients. I had what I thought was a great explanation until I sent his Facebook log. From what I saw in the CNN article, I expected his small, dense LDL would have upticked, which he never got an NRM lipid test, and his TAG-HDL ratio to go a bit south, which it seemed to improve. His body fat to drop a bit, but for him to lose mostly H2O weight, which his body fat supposedly made up 20-plus pounds on his drop, according to a sophisticated body fat measurement, and him to have ravenous hunger, which he subjectively said that he didn't have. Rob, what are your thoughts on the Twinkie diet?
Can I just shoot myself? You know, there have been some really good write-ups on this. Like, I've been trying to get myself fired up to write something on this, but Whole Health Source had a really, really good write-up on this. A couple other folks had some nice assessments, and these guys ended up picking this thing apart in a sufficient way that I feel like I don't have a ton to contribute to the discussion, in that they pointed out some really key features of this thing. One was that, you know, this professor of nutrition started off with an over 30% body fat level. And you know, they were applauding his high carb, low fat diet that got him there in the beginning. And the professor commentates that you know, he just couldn't control himself from overeating while eating his standard chow. But then when he started eating this kind of weighed measured Twinkie diet, where he was on a very regimented schedule and a hypocaloric schedule to boot, or you know, most importantly, then he was able to stick with this thing. And there's just so many interesting features with this. One is just that whenever we stick people on a hypocaloric scenario, it almost, I won't say doesn't matter, but in some ways the food quality becomes significantly less important with regards to like beneficial metabolic changes. Like if somebody is sick and they're overweight and they're metabolically deranged, with this doctor obviously was, if he was 31-33% body fat, then sticking him on a calorie restricted diet is going to benefit him. There's absolutely no doubt about that. The big problem that we face is that we can't seem to get people to do this in a free living scenario. People do not stick to programs like this, whether it's Twinkies or whether it's otherwise good food. And even like what he said in the beginning of his write-up on his own study was that his supposedly good foods he was overeating on, and it really begs the question, why? You know, what's going on there? What's broken? And again, Stefan at Whole Health Source, he broke this thing down really well, which is that we have some really complex neurophysiological regulations of appetite, and if we're eating the wrong types of foods in the, you know, the anything that starts to causing problems with liver function, omega-3, omega-6 imbalances, inflammatory issues with lectins and whatnot, we start getting derailment in the neuroregulation of appetite. When we can't regulate appetite, it really doesn't matter what foods we're eating, we're going to overeat on them. But the interesting thing with that is that if we're generally feeding people protein and fat as kind of a basis, you know, this kind of lowish carb paleo approach, it is damn hard to overeat on this. And so this, you know, the thing is kind of a stunt. I guess it's kind of interesting. The professor, when he commented on this other guy's website that, you know, thank you for discussing this. This was the point of my whole thing, to get people talking. And, you know, I don't know that it really was to get people talking. I mean, it is kind of an interesting finding, but it just obscures the facts a lot. When people aren't well steeped in this stuff, then it's just another layer of minutiae to try to explain. You know, if we can get people generally eating a lowish carb paleo kind of deal, protein, veggies, some good fats, we can usually get some sort of an 80-20 buy-in on this, and they have great appetite control, they have good body composition, they have good blood lipids, and it's something that appears to be sustainable over the long haul. Whereas this professor's standard nutritional approach was unsustainable. The guy was heading towards obesity. And so I don't know. What do you think about this, Andy? I just think that this thing ends up making it incredibly frustrating to try to explain the nuances of this stuff to people. Maybe it's good. Maybe, you know, we can get in and start talking the neurophysiology of appetite and all this stuff. But then it's kind of like, okay, now we need another comparison, and another person needs to eat a different type of diet, and we kind of look at this type of stuff. And, you know, like the question here where you've got the you know, the clients that want their excuse to eat whatever they want to eat. I mean, in some ways it's kind of like, okay, go for it, but it's going to limit your results. But what do you think about this whole thing?
I'm tired of talking about this, Rob, but the only thing the only thing I'll say that kind of frustrates me is, like, it's like this short-term experiment, but what we lose focus on, for me and some of the clients I've talked to about it, is that I think most people would agree generally long-term that the quality of the food you eat has some type of impact on your health. Now, I think some people will debate what that quality is, whether it's grains or whatever. But so, like, in your gut, you look at this and you know, like, this is a freaking stupid idea. And no one can live off Twinkies and not have any long-term health problems, in my opinion. Like, I don't even know if we need to study that, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, if they're on a calorie-restricted plan, then it buys you some headroom. You know, it buys you some headroom. But the thing is people don't live that way in free-living scenarios. And that's really, and he made some commentary in his the preamble to his study, talking about, like, food deserts where, you know, people live in these urban environments where there's no fruit or vegetable stands, or, you know, the quality of the meat is really suspect because it's usually more like a Slim Jim. And so his thing was that there's the potentiality that people living in food deserts could have better health by eating super low quality food like he did, taking a vitamin supplement, and just making sure that they do caloric restriction. But the thing is that doesn't fucking work, you know? And so it's one of these things that's like, okay, I guess interesting data point, and we have now caused a massive amount of confusion and driven the boat down. You know, it's kind of like, okay, yes, this can work. We can make this work. Maybe even we can make it quasi healthy because we have a massive amount of calorie restriction. So what? Is this going to benefit anybody on a on a broader scale? Do we get general buy-in on this? And you know, the interesting thing is, even with the calorie restriction, we're not going to see improvements in any type of autoimmune function with this. And we just know that from people tinkering with the zone in CrossFit land and not seeing improvements in autoimmune function. You know, not significant, not reversing it like what we're seeing with the food quality approach. So it's just damn annoying. I mean, on the one hand, I like somebody said, you know, props to this guy for just uncovering this stone, I guess. But I think it's caused way more damage than good. It's just confused the hell out of people.
When we're done with the podcast, I'm going to go have my five fries.
Five fries. Evander, you can have five fries.
Matt from Centerville CrossFit, hopefully that was helpful. We kind of got out of control on that one.
Yeah, and hopefully that answers it for folks. And I'll try to do a really quick just commentary on that and link to a couple of really good write-ups on that whole thing. I don't really feel like I have anything unique to add to the discussion at this point, other than this doctor is just completely disregarding the neurophysiology of appetite and how, you know, what are the best strategies for affecting change in people in free living humans, you know, when they're out actually living and they're not subjecting themselves to the discipline of doing a study that's being followed by the media and whatnot. So,
all right, Rob, moving on. This one could be the question of the day. Hopefully it won't take you 30 minutes to answer. Question from Jay. Hey, Rob, just wondering what you believe the best program for being prepared for the unknown and unknowable, as they say, would be. Obviously, there's CrossFit in its current incarnation. I know you're a fan of CrossFit football over that. I've also wondered about Christopher Summers' gymnastics watts. Is there anything else that'd be better than those listed I don't know of? My fitness goals have changed a little. I'm just trying to figure out the best program to get me as prepared as one can be for anything and everything. Thanks, Rob.
Oh, wow. You know,
I'm gonna blame Greg Glassman for even coming up with the idea to be prepared for anything and everything, Rob, right now. I'm just going to say that.
I think it's
popularizing the idea.
Popularizing the concept. Well, you know, here's the thing. You popularize that concept, but then you steer the whole boat down the path of being a sport, and then you actually kind of turn your back on those basic concepts. Andy and I were talking about some stuff before we let the podcast roll, you know, that the early incarnation of CrossFit, which was this real basic template built around gymnastics, O-lifting, sprinting, and some smart couplet, triplet-oriented metabolic conditioning. There was some real power there, and particularly if you put in some MEBB type strength progression into that background, you know, having some thought towards both maximum strength progression but also skills progression, you know, 10 years down the road here, we should have some people able to muscle up, press to handstand, you know, swing to support and some really complex stuff. We have some increasing work capacities because of some, you know, some monsters entering the game, but we really don't see a massively developed skill set, not like what we could, but that's a whole other thing, probably an appropriate deal for a different topic. But this whole unknown and unknowable gig, you know, the one caveat that I'll throw in with this is that the time indexing starts becoming really critical at some point when we start When the unknowable starts pushing out to like 6 hours and 8 hours and 20 hours and stuff like that, then the preparation necessary for that starts whittling off the short end stuff so massively that it becomes some very different games that we're talking about. But, you know, other than that, then I would say some stuff that is built around gymnastics, O-lifting, and sprinting, you know, as basic power development, as basic skill development, mobility, kinesthetic awareness. And, you know, I would do something akin to like say like one day a week you do some O-lifts, another day a week you do some sprints, and then a third day you do some MoveNat kind of inspired type stuff, which MoveNat lifts and carries and throws and climbs and does all this different stuff. But from my MoveNat perspective, and maybe we'll get Erwan on here at some point and he can kind of articulate his thoughts on it, but this is fully like my take on this gig, is that we start doing some context oriented training. Cause like when I went to the MoveNat gig, we had 3 days where it was raining sideways and we were trying to clean and jerk logs in mud barefoot, you know, in the rain with like newts running out from under our feet and stuff like that while we're stomping around in these muddy bogs. And it just changes everything. It completely changes everything. You know, your grip starts failing when you start trying to work bar muscle ups on a log that has a 6 or 8 inch diameter. That's challenging when you do bar muscle ups on a 6 or 8 inch diameter log when you're covered with mud and it's pouring rain, then it becomes virtually impossible until you figure out some of the tricks in this stuff. So I think in general, like, you want to build this broad, general, inclusive capacity, and then you want to work context. You know, work in the cold, work in the rain. When you're doing this stuff, though, it's with the idea or the foreknowledge that you're doing this to prepare yourself for working in an austere environment, and that you may see some declination or some decrease in your basic numbers, you know, your metabolic conditioning, your basic strength and all that stuff. But you're trying to subject yourself to some austere environments. And then really, I think that some of the most powerful value of anything like this type of training, and CrossFit in particular, is that you are able to subject people to an amount of suck that is just virtually impossible to find anywhere else. Like wrestling and fighting, you can experience that type of metabolic demands and the challenges and everything. But when you put people in a competitive environment, and then, you know, nobody likes to lose, everybody wants to put their best foot forward and all that sort of jive. So when the competition deal is on, and then you add to that workouts that are designed not to train but to destroy, and, you know, basically, like, how much work can we induce in or subject an organism to before they get rhabdo or Cushing's disease from a overtraining syndrome, then you have this environment in which you're going to find out what a person is made of really quickly, and you can take people to a place of misery that they can really figure out that right brain, left brain type integration. You know, like, okay, rationally I know I'm just in a workout, but emotionally I think I'm going to die. How do I rectify these things? And so I think that some amount of a psychological preparation, such that you've gone to absolutely horrible places and then talk yourself through it and are able to go forward, I think there's some huge value in that. And probably the mental toughness is as big a deal as anything else. You know, you see these stories about, like, the dude that got his arm pinned under a rock and he, like, cut his arm off at the elbow with, like, a dull knife and everything. Like, that dude's probably just way tougher than I am. Like, I would have probably ended up being Coyote Chow out there under that rock instead of cutting my arm off. You know, I don't know. But I think that general physical preparedness that you can get from sprinting, gymnastics derivative stuff, O-lifting and powerlifting is fantastic. And then really, you know, the Metcon, I think, is most valuable, not so much in the physical preparation, but more in the mental and emotional preparation, that you talk yourself into the idea that you can do anything.
That was an impressively long answer, Rob.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm hoping that I can forestall some of the later questions. Yeah.
Rob, I agree with all your ideas. And the only dimension I would consider then is, I think that idea of that template works really well, and then you kind of think about who you are as an athlete. So we've got some folks that are like former powerlifters, and I'm like, hey, if we're talking about well-rounded fitness, I kind of like that word better than unknowing and unknowable. Then I'm like, you probably need to do less heavy, you know, lifting. We just need to maintain that. We need to spend some time body awareness, gymnastics, move nat, teach you the O lifts, and vice versa. But I think that idea that you laid out works perfectly.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought experiment, and I think probably more people than not would benefit from a generalist program. But then this was another thing that Andy and I were talking about before we let roll, is that folks who've been in a generalist program for a while, you reach a point where you start asking some questions like, well, what next? And you know, where do I go? And if you don't have something guiding what you're up to, then it becomes tough. And this is where, like, I would kind of even lump some of the endurance type efforts in this, but I mean, if somebody really is geeked out on a particular sportive event and they just want to stay competitive throughout their life, then that's probably enough. But if you aren't chasing some sort of technicality, if there's not something that is new and technical, or just the skill set that you're playing around with needs to be deepened and improved, then all that we're talking about then is typically some sort of work capacity, whether it's maximum strength or whatever. And it just gets so hard to make progress. And like return on investment gets laboriously slow. And it's not to say don't do that, but I think when you've got some technical elements that you can hone and get excited about the technical elements, then it's much more rewarding, and also much more forgiving on you in the long term, orthopedically and metabolically and all that.
Skill-based training is so much more fun, Rob.
Yeah, it is. And you know what? I'm excited to see more of Erwan's stuff with MoveNat. It kind of hit the scene. But it's just interesting. Like he has always adopted this very skill-based building capacity via skills versus just simply a dumb capacity. And it'll be interesting to see how all this stuff grows and develops.
Are you ready to move on? That was 11 minutes.
I'm ready to roll, and I'll make the other ones, I promise.
No, you're
good. At the wheel, so, yeah.
These are the most popular questions, Rob, so they'll probably never go away.
God help us, yes.
Cool. Got a question from Ben. He said, so, I've been going super low carb for about 5 weeks, where my cheat day would consist of a couple of pieces of fruit, maybe twice a week, working out 3 to 4 days a week, pretty much meat, veggies, and eggs in my diet, and coffee with a little cream. So I was at a location where they had Halloween candy, and I thought to myself, F it, I'm going for it. So I had probably 10 pieces of your standard garbage of the world Halloween size small candy bars and roughly one-third of a Coca-Cola. Then I almost died, I think. I went pale. I couldn't even handle sitting down. I had to go outside where it was raining and lay down for about 10 minutes. Vision was going away. Breathing was hard. Calling 911 entered my thoughts. Then was able to get up and throw up, went and ate some meat, and felt better. Could you talk a bit about what was going on metabolically and perhaps the dangers of going super low carb and then eating a deadly amount of sugar? Thanks. I've listened to all 52 of your episodes. Then we got a follow-up from Morgan, who says, Ben, we must be twins or something. I've lived this experience too many times now. Super strict, low fruit, low carb, Whole30 style paleo for 3 to 4 weeks. Then a little refined sugar throws me off the rails, and I experience all of the mental, physical trauma you mentioned. Feels like an anxiety attack. Worse, it gets worse. I recover for a few hours or overnight, then I binge on an even higher volume of the sugary stuff. Sometimes it takes 2 to 3 days of bender-like behavior before it finally breaks like a fever. Funny, I'm pretty much a non-drinker, and a few drinks never prompts the overwhelming need to have more. But with sugar, I'm like Nick Cage in Leaving Las Vegas. Rob, would love to hear your thoughts.
My thought is don't do that stuff.
Rob, that is not the question.
Oh, man. I just... Gee whiz.
Well, I mean, maybe you could start with... We actually had this talk the other day because some folks that I think were coming up on like a holiday and they knew they were going to have a drastic increase in their carbohydrate intake, and you were recommending, well, maybe they slowly kind of climb that up at least for the few days before to kind of prepare the body. I mean, maybe you can kind of start there. Obviously, yes, Rob, don't go out and have 75 candy bars and 4 Cokes because it will not turn out well for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a stumper in some ways because it's just like, dude, you know, if we change this out and it's like, dude, it was hookers and crack and like I almost died, and it's like, yeah, I don't
doubt. It'd be so much better if it was hookers.
Yeah, and it would be, yeah, it'd be so much more understandable. I mean, you get wired up in this low-carb scenario, and it's – I think we talked about this a time or two, or maybe it was in a nightmare. I'm not really too sure if it comes together at this point, but – you know, when we wire our system up to run more efficiently on fats, part of our tissues can and do convert over to running on fats and ketone bodies, including, you know, our brain can run on it, other tissues can run on it. But what happens is that I wouldn't even say a transient level, but on an adaptive level, less of our body is running on glucose. So that means by default that we are insulin or glucose intolerant in certain tissues. So now the high carbers will start freaking out. They're like, see, low carb messes up your metabolism. It's like, no, we have an adaptation here. And it's really not that much different than if we have somebody who is generally eating high carb and then we have them dramatically cut their carbohydrate intake. They're lethargic and tired and sleepy and everything. Interestingly, they don't have the type of severity like what these folks did, where they're typically, you know, like almost vomiting, or you almost have something like a diabetic coma type deal. Because what we had in this scenario is that a huge onrush of glucose and fructose into the system, this spikes blood sugar levels that just keep going up and up and up because the body is insulin resistant because it's been running on fat. And so the blood sugar levels get sky high, and then we get a massive over-release of insulin out of the pancreas because the body is in a panic mode now because the glucose levels could be getting high enough that you could cause some significant brain damage or something like that, or you know, something like a diabetic coma. And then you end up crashing the blood sugar levels, and you get this rebound hypoglycemia where the blood sugar levels are even lower than what we started off with. And so this is where, you know, the natural hormonal enhancement, the metabolic diet, anabolic diet, like these cyclic low-carb approaches, part of what they're trying to do, and this is kind of what Barry Sears tried to do also, is you try to offer something for everybody. Hey, guys, eat a low-carb diet during the week, and then you can go hog-freaking-wild on the weekend and eat donuts and pancakes and whatever, and so you can live a decadent, indulgent life on both ends of the spectrum, high fat in the weeks and then high carb on the weekends. And the reality is that it doesn't end up working all that well, and the usual downside is that people feel like absolute crap when they go on these carb benders. And Matt Lalonde and I were talking about this, and the carb refeed that most people need, depending on where you're at with your training, it either needs to happen immediately post-workout or it needs to be of moderate volume and intensity of carbohydrate intake, or you're going to experience problems like this. And it's probably not all that healthy to do. Like Andy said at when he reeled me back from just completely going fetal on this question, if you know you're going to say like hit the family you know, holiday event, and you're going to be doing some pies and some treats, and your carbohydrate is generally going to be higher, then for maybe a week before you go to the family event, increasing your carbohydrate intake incrementally, say like 20 grams of carbs for a couple of days, basically a piece of fruit and then like two pieces of fruit, then, you know, a couple of days later, such that by the end of the whole thing, you've increased the amount of carbohydrate you're taking in from, say, like 50 grams a day up to 150 grams a day or 200 grams a day, then you'll probably be utilizing glucose as a primary fuel source more so, and so you shouldn't experience these problems so badly. But this is where, like, it just gets a little bit maddening trying to, especially as we have an influx of new people coming in. You throw this information out there, and then you end up with folks who are new that need to just be towing the line. Just eat. Just eat meat and veggies and fat and be good. And then you throw this chunk of information out there that's like, well, before you do a carb bender, start increasing your carbs so you can adapt to it. And then we end up with people spun out, and they don't get any traction on this stuff. And this is where, like, it almost starts necessitating like a closed forum kind of gig for super geeky type questions, because we have a massive number of people who are coming to the site listening to the podcast that need like basic help. You know, they're still trying to figure out what a protein, a carb, a fat is. And then we have questions like this, which are just going to the dark side of the moon. And it's super confusing for folks. So, guys, just eat what you're supposed to eat and don't screw around with other stuff, and make it easy on all of us. Okay. Jeez.
Rob, I feel like you're angrier than I am today, and you've had coffee. Wow.
I'm cranky today.
I know.
That's what it is. I'm cranky today. part of what it is, you know, I've been trying to figure out how to get a message out to folks that works. And, you know, like, I feel like the book's doing great. Like, we're getting some real good buy-in on that and all that stuff. But then it still comes back around to, are you catering to the elite? Are you catering to the masses? Who needs more help? The masses do. But then when you deal with that, then it's basically like eat meat, vegetables, and some fat. Go to sleep. Exercise a little. And then it's kind of done. So, you know, you want to look at some of this other interesting stuff. But then it's totally Pandora's box. You let a little information out. This is like, I feel like 2 years down the road now, or maybe a solid year down the road, I feel like we kinda sorta have a little bit of anchorage with the concept of like post-workout nutrition. People are like, if I want to get lean, do this protocol. If I want to you know, optimize performance through this protocol. But it's taken so much work to get people there, and to some degree, I'm just waiting for the next wave of folks to come in and you know, who haven't taken the time to dig through the podcasts and everything and get to that stuff. But just trying to figure out how to get this information out there such that it addresses everybody's needs, but everybody's different. And so, I don't know. It's interesting.
I am a unique flower, Rob. You must help me.
You are, and you're a big one too, dude.
All right, moving on. A question from Kat Alberts. I like that handle. It's good. Says, congrats on your anniversary, boys. Finished reading the book and listened to almost half the podcast about 2 weeks in. I'm very happy with all the info and have changed my diet completely from almost vegan to full paleo. Still going strong on my quest to save my gallbladder and dissolve the gallstone. Aside from that, I read some stuff online about the research by Professor Cynthia Kenyon. Her roundworms doubled their lifespan if they never ate carbohydrates. Well, 20 days to 40 days, but still impressive. And lots more research with genes, cancer, and IGF, all in the worms. As far as I can see, her research on worms parallels yours in scientific literature. Very interested to hear what you make of her work. Kind regards, and look forward to the next podcast.
It's really interesting stuff. And, you know, a couple of years ago for the performance menu, I was kind of geeking on this whole thing, intermittent fasting, ketosis, performance, health, longevity, you know, how do we find a nice inflection point on this stuff? But I'm still not super sure if a generally low carb diet in humans is going to make us live longer. Like I think that there are some biomarkers that we're modifying, including insulin expression, mTOR, glycolytic damage, SIRT1 gene expression. There's some really interesting things that seem to get flipped on in a low-carb environment. We also see less oxidative damage when we are pumping nutrients through the phase 2 mitochondrial oxidation, which is basically a beta fatty acid oxidation versus glycolysis and then pumping carbohydrates through the phase 1 mitochondrial pathways. So we see a lot of different things converge on this low or low-ish carb side of things. But it's still largely conjecture as to whether or not we're going to see some legitimate life extension out of this stuff. I think low-ish carb paleo, minimum amount of polyunsaturated fats to make your engines work the way that we want. Don't supplement with omega-6s really at all. Avoid gut irritating foods. Get more of your fats from probably saturated fats. I'm leaning more and more and more that direction because of the low oxidative stress that they impose. All this stuff totally makes sense. Whether or not it's actually going to bear any fruit at the end, I don't know, but it totally makes sense, and we get more and more data that kind of supports this stuff. So this roundworm experiment is really interesting. My thought is that probably what we'll see is a mild, if at all, increase in total lifespan out of a protocol like this. But I think that what we'll see is a doubling or more of effective lifespan. Like instead of people seeing significant physiological decline in their 50s, 60s, we see that stuff pushed off to like 80s, 90s before we see the wheels really start falling off the wagon. Kind of, I think Art Devaney is probably a pretty good example of something along that line. Clarence Bass also, although, you know, Clarence has always eaten a much higher carb deal, but he's aging good, so we'll see how that stuff goes. But there's no doubt that some smart training that's non-exhaustive, good lifestyle practices, good stress management, and all that are all going to add up together in a very favorable way.
It's all bunk, Rob. and you know it. Good question, Kat Alberts. We'll give you handle number 8, my 8th favorite angle.
Yeah, it's a goodie. That one's a goodie.
All right, next got a comment from Charlotte. Met you at the South Brooklyn last year. Thanks so much for these podcasts. They are so informative. I think you ran the question about the removed thyroid in episode 48 already, but the repeat prompted me to write with my question. I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's 15 years ago as a senior in college. I've been on Synthroid, generic version, since then, my levels being adjusted every 6 to 12 months as my TSH levels have changed. Here's the thing. I've never had a symptom of low thyroid ever. No weight gain, no sluggishness, no dry skin, no hair falling out, nada. So this spring, in conjunction with the 30-day paleo challenge, I stopped the Synthroid. Nothing changed. Still no symptoms. Sometime this summer, I got my TSH levels checked. They were through the roof, like in the 20s. So I'm back on the drugs, but again, zero symptoms. What's up? I'm 37, female, breastfeeding once a day, eat paleo plus some dairy, almost always grass-fed. Don't avoid nightshades, but I do put down a dozen eggs a week at least, and I'm not shy with the nuts. Pretty good about sleep. Always have been. It was tough for a while with the little one, but he's pretty good now. Train CrossFit 3 to 4 times a week. Capoeira 2 to 3 times a week. Sorry for such a long question. I realize I probably just need to suck it up and get myself to an endocrinologist, but wondered if you had some brilliant insight that I could bring to the table.
So, I mean, the basic question is why is she not suffering symptoms despite low thyroid production, right?
Yes.
I don't know.
It's a good thing I'm here to help you, Rob.
I don't know. And just so folks understand, like, if you have low conversion of T4 to T3 or just generally low T4, T3 levels, then TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, is going to increase trying to push the production of the T4 and T3. I don't know. I mean, I just don't know why you wouldn't manifest symptoms. It's interesting that either being on Synthroid or off Synthroid doesn't really seem to do all that much one way or the other. She might have either a super high density of thyroid receptor sites in her cells that she's able to function on super low levels, or there's something else kind of going on here, because there doesn't seem to have been any change in how she was looking, feeling, performing, whether she was on Synthroid or not. The only thing that changed was that TSH levels went up. So I don't know what's going on with this, other than to some degree you're just kind of lucky in that it seems like you get along pretty good whether you're on Synthroid or not. It sounds like probably being on Synthroid would be smart, so that we're not just cranking up TSH levels, which can have some other feedback problems. But I don't know what's going on there. I've thought about this, and I don't even know where else to go for diagnostic measures other than looking at like some gene expression stuff to see how what type of thyroid receptor site density is going on, but I'm not even super sure what that would answer.
Yep. All right, Rob, moving on. Question from John. Rob, I have a friend whose 8-year-old son has been diagnosed with an ulcer. As he was telling me, my first thought was paleo diet, almost like a Pavlovian response. They said in his stomach, so I'm assuming it's a peptic ulcer. No other remarkable history other than he was 6 to 7 weeks premature. My Google Foo came up empty of meaningful results, searching for things like ulcer plus gluten and ulcer plus celiac, but I thought I may have missed something. Any insights will be greatly appreciated. Continued great job on the show. FYI, it's November 3rd, and I don't see the show in iTunes. Not sure if there's an issue, but it usually shows up the right way. First of all, I am the iTunes issue. When we switched to Libsyn, I got a little confused, but I think we're set now, Rob. iTunes will deliver the programs as expected, and no one needs to get worried about it.
We didn't have a massive number of complaints this morning, so yesterday morning, so I think we're good now. So
progress.
We ended up having way more downloaders. Like we always joke, and we have 6 listeners, and in fact, it's nearly 18 listeners. And so we had to go to a different host, and so it took us a little while to get the bugs worked out of that. So.
18 listeners.
We had 3 times more than what we thought.
300%, buddy. 300% growth.
And actually, it was still the same 6 listeners. They were just downloading it 3 times for some reason. So.
Answer the question, Rob. Answer the question.
Okay. So, the celiac and ulcer stuff, like grain intolerance and ulcer, there's definitely some stuff there. But folks also usually, if you do some digging around with hyperinsulinism and ulcers, then you can find some stuff with that. The fact that it's a young kid, though, I suspect that they probably either have, like the classic grain intolerance or dairy intolerance or something, which started creating some irritation in the gut, and probably has like a H. pylori infection going on, a Helicobacter pylori infection, which is kind of right at the heart of a lot of what's going on with the GI ulcers. I mean, standard grain-free, dairy-free, paleo diet, I would be shocked if it didn't help with the whole situation. It might be one thing. This kid should probably get some sort of a culture performed to see if he does have some H. pylori, and then if he does, then some specific antibiotics could help address that. But it doesn't. But that will not address why he got it to start off with. And this is where, you know, a paleo type diet could prevent this reoccurring. Might even be able to change the environment such that his own immune system and the environment of the gut could be changed, such the H. pylori, or if it's a different bacteria that's really at fault here, could be displaced, and you get a normal flora set up. But you should be able to see some improvements with this, with some standard dietary tinkering.
It's amazing.
Shocker, I know.
Just kidding. Sorry, no caffeine. Blame it on the no caffeine, Rob. Not salty today. Next, we got a question from Victoria. So, Rob, I think I dug this out of the comments. Hopefully you know what's going on here, because I now realize I'm confused. But
Vaguely.
She says, hey, Rob, just a thought on the first question. How useful is a sugar-free electrolyte solution? My understanding is that the major mechanism of sodium uptake from the gut is via the sodium glucose co-transporter. Don't get me wrong. I don't think that a sugar-laden electrolyte concoction is the way to go, but if you need to uptake some sodium, you need to eat some carbs, at least from my understanding. Rob says, really just depends on the need. Do you need that glucose? If not, you'll absorb an isotonic solution just fine. Victoria follows up. I thought it was the other way around. How badly do you need the sodium? My understanding was that you need glucose to utilize the major sodium uptake mechanism in your gut. It's one of those fun facts they taught us in physiology that actually stuck with me. Rob says he will check into that. Rob, what are your thoughts on this?
Victoria has it remembered exactly the opposite. So it's the glucose-sodium co-transport mechanism. And so what this is because glucose is a large organic molecule, and we're generally moving against a concentration gradient in our blood, depending on what you have going on, unless you're one of the jokers who were trying to kill themselves with Halloween candy, most people are roaming around with typically more of a glucose concentration in their blood than they are in the gut. And obviously this can vary based on what type of intake we have, you know, from meals and whatnot. But the basic mechanism here, because we have a large organic molecule and we're generally working against a concentration gradient, is that we will co-transport a sodium molecule out of our system and then to bring a glucose molecule into the system. And then so that basically what she's describing here, Victoria remembered the mechanism. She just remembered it 180 degrees off. And then if we're really talking about just general sodium uptake, that can work via passive diffusion. There are some active transport mechanisms that work with that too, but it's not an issue at all. The issue is whether or not you need glucose, which is what I was saying originally. I didn't fully grasp in that first question that she had simply remembered this thing in reverse.
Well said, Rob. That was the shortest answer yet today.
And the most complex question in public, so.
It's the simple ones that are hard, my friend.
Yes.
Next, I got a question from Kevin. He says, I've got a ton of autoimmune stuff going on, so I adhere to a very strict Rob Wolf paleo diet. Note, Rob, you now have your own paleo diet. I like that. Look at that.
Oh, God. We have the shark, man.
Including ridiculous quantities of fish oil per the Rob Wolf calculator. I just got a side of grass-fed beef, so this winter I plan on eating just wild-caught fish and beef, roughly 50-50. Come spring, I'd like to add in some other pastured meat sources for variety with a mix over the course of the year of roughly one-third fish, one-third fish, one-third beef, and one-third other, mostly pork and poultry, but also lamb, venison, and buffalo. I love buffalo. Ordering grass-fed beef is pretty straightforward, but I'm less confident, re the optimal diet and environment for pastured pork and poultry. I've been researching, but unlike beef, there seems to be less consensus on what our pigs and chickens should be eating. Apparently, even pigs and chickens that are pasture-raised, free-ranging foragers are still always supplemented with a fair amount of grains in their diet. For instance, Joel Salatin of Omnivore's Dilemma fame says his foraging broilers get only 20% from grass, bugs, worms, grubs, and the rest from corn, toasted soybean, and kelp, which is scooped into long troughs. And pastured pigs seem to be fed just about anything. Two questions. One, obviously any pastured pork and poultry is going to be better than the industrial version, but how much better? The nutritional differences between grass-fed and industrial beef is significant, but does this nutritional advantage hold with these other pastured animals, especially given how much grain and other PUFAs they consume? Rob Wolf, what are your thoughts?
Oh, man. The breakdown on this stuff, I haven't seen a ton. It hasn't been as well researched as the grass-fed beef type things. It's some better. Like, you usually get some better carotenoids and stuff like that. But as soon as you start feeding critters CLA when you start feeding them grains and stuff like that, and I'm not sure what the inflection point is, whether it's like 5% of calories or 10 or 20 or whatever, but you start seeing some decrease in things like CLA. You start seeing some significant displacement in the omega-3, omega-6 profile. I think it's still much better quality, and it certainly tastes a lot better. Like, we had Nikki's dad came over last night, and we're out of grass-fed meat, and so I went to Rayleigh's, and I got what looked like some pretty good pork spare ribs, and they tasted okay, but they didn't taste great to me. They smelled okay, but not great, and I'm just kind of realizing that I'm so used to eating really high-quality food that when I go with standard conventional stuff, it's not very good by comparison, like the taste and the quality and all that stuff. So I think that you're still money is well placed trying to go for an option like this, but it's definitely a different deal.
Number two, how does pork and poultry compare to beef, lamb, and bison? Should we, as a general rule, be limiting pork and poultry, even pastured, favoring grass-fed beef and wild-caught fish? I think this is what Dr. Kurt Harris suggests. Is eating one-third of my meat from pork and poultry too much? Would someone with a history of autoimmune issues be better off avoiding or limiting the pork and poultry? Would all that pork and poultry tend to offset some of the beneficial effects of the beef and fish?
You know, since this is actually kind of a nice, control experimental kind of gig, which is, can we get this person to a point where we're essentially like symptom free from autoimmune disease, you know, essentially put it in remission. And that's where I would go, like the grass-fed meat, wild-caught fish, stick really exclusive to that. And then I would just tinker with this and introduce the pastured stuff and see how you do with it. And it, you know, it would be really helpful to get feedback from you about how it went. In an ideal world, I would probably stick more with the grass-fed meat, wild-caught fish, and make the even the pastured poultry and pork maybe a little bit more randomized. You know, when you want a little bit of a something different or a treat or something like that, maybe go with that. But it just kind of, it depends on how you're feeling from it. That's kind of the spot that I would, you know, really draw most of your conclusions from. And as far as like whether, you know, one third versus two thirds are going to be the issue, I really just don't know on that. That's just stuff that you would have to tinker with.
Yes. Good pork is good.
Indeed. And we've had some good stuff, like Katie's mom.
Oh.
Some pork. And it is, they feed them a lot of apples and oranges and almonds. And I know they get some grain, but they get much more kind of forage like that. And it is insanely good. Like, it is just the most amazing pork I've ever had. It's phenomenal.
Yes. I can't wait till a poor little pig needs to be slaughtered again.
Indeed.
Next up, question from Dan. Hey, Rob, my sister went to an endocrinologist who seemed to be okay with paleo, but has some issues after getting back for some conference. Saturated fat is no more than 7% and should not be eaten late at night because it can cause fatty acid syndrome, which will destroy fundamental nutrients in the body. Also, folate deficiency sounds like a potential issue. Could you explain why this woman is wrong? That one was for you, Rob.
Oh, man. This whole fundamental nutrients in the body, if anybody out there is a Dr. Strangelove fan and, like, dude was that went crazy and ended up the Army general or Air Force major or whatever he was, and, you know, he went crazy and his whole deal was that they're trying to steal our vital bodily fluids. And right. This just smacks of that so badly. It just totally reminds me of that. But I have no idea what the hell this person is talking about. Cordain wrote a really great paper, even when people were hammering on him about him not being excited about higher saturated fat intakes. But he was kind of blasting the AMA and some other folks, saying that making recommendations of below 10% saturated fat intake was nuts because, you know, there's just no scientific or kind of evolutionary basis for it. Like, there's no ancestral diet that we can put together that had less than 10 or 15% saturated fat in it. And, you know, now we know much better from that anyway. And this whole, like, fatty acid syndrome, I have no idea what that is, cannot find anything on it, and then destroy fundamental nutrients in the body. That's like the biggest bunch of boogeyman scariness that means absolutely nothing. I is just absolutely ridiculous. And then if you check out the you know, Lauren Cordain's contemporary diet based on, or paleo diet based on contemporary foods, folate, you end up getting like 1,200% of the RDA on folate by eating these wacky things called meat and vegetables. So I egads, man.
Just, holy cats, Rob.
Holy cats. This is one of those things that Andy sends me the notes here like a day or two in advance so I can read them and do any research that I need to do on it. And I will sometimes have problems going to bed at night. I am so either angry or like out of sorts reading some of this stuff. And this is one of them where I just want to scream at this person. It's like, what are you talking about? You're a doctor. You need to do better than this. But alas, that's not going to happen. So yeah, this person is completely out in left field. And if they want to come on the show and talk about it, we would love to have her. And I'll be super nice, I promise.
Yes. Moving on, Rob. We're going to try to get you out of this. Question from Ian. Hey, Rob, have you heard anything about a low-carb diet triggering cortisol production? I've read this, but I'm assuming it is the low-cals and not low-carbs that is triggering the stress response. I've also read that cortisol gets raised along with glucagon. What are your thoughts? And I'm going to read your thoughts first, Rob, then you can comment. Many people yammer about this, but the science is just not there. Where are the extremely high cortisol levels in ketogenic diet-controlled epileptics? If someone is trying to eat low-carb and train at a very high intensity, I could see a problem, but that is where cyclic low-carb and other protocols solve this potentiality. Your thoughts, Rob Wolf.
And then, was there another comment?
Oh, yeah. You want me to read this one?
I can throw my thoughts in there and then focus.
Yeah, the other one's a little different. You can address that one separately. It's fine. Just go.
There's a couple of folks out there. Like, I think Anthony Colpo just had a recent paper, and there's always somebody, it seems like, of late yammering about this stuff. And it's what they're doing is they're looking at protocols in which people are already on a high-carb, low-fat diet, and then they get put on a low-carb diet, and it's stressful. And the reason why it's stressful is because these people are used to running on a bunch of carbohydrate. When you restrict that carbohydrate, they're insulin resistant. They can't access body fat for energy. And so their body goes into a stress mode trying to find some glucose. And the place that they find the glucose is by releasing cortisol to liberate glucose out of the liver. Now, if you were to eat significant amount of protein and fat, you would blunt that response, because you could get gluconeogenesis that would then release a little bit of glucose from the protein, and you wouldn't have the cortisol response. And this is actually part of how you can take somebody who is kind of type 2 diabetic, who is suffering elevated cortisol from blood sugar crashes and from the fact that the liver can no longer sense the elevated blood glucose levels and blood insulin levels, and is actually sending a panic response to the adrenals to release cortisol to raise blood sugar levels. You can fix all this stuff by feeding people a high-protein, high-fat diet, because we're able to start fixing the neuroregulation of appetite. We provide enough protein that could be converted into glucose to maintain blood glucose levels. High circulating blood fats will minimize glucagon release and cortisol release. Everything's cool. It works great. But what these guys are doing is cherry-picking studies in which people are not fat-adapted. They're in a stress adaptation response, typically hypocaloric, being shifted from a high-carb scenario to a low-carb, and not only low-carb, but also typically hypocaloric, and their body goes into panic. And there's just no surprise that this is what the situation is. But they have the cart so backwards, it's kind of insane, because, again, you know, this is how we can fundamentally reverse type 2 diabetes, is by removing that over-production of insulin, by removing the excessive substrate of excessive carbohydrates, particularly fructose, and start changing that deranged liver function. So these folks are just out to lunch. And again, like to wrap this, so this is our generalist thing. And then as usual, we have a subsection of people who may be elite level athletes for whom a very low carbohydrate diet is probably not appropriate for them, particularly, MMA, CrossFit, something like that, very glycolytically demanding activities need to refill their glycogen stores, both liver and muscular to some degrees. Otherwise, we're going to have some problems. But that's not rocket science. That's just called post-workout nutrition. And the people who need that are typically lean, fit, strong athletes. So, they're nothing new here, but it's certainly exciting to try to whip this stuff up and get people all spun out about it.
Five fries and the Twinkie diet, Rob.
Oh, God.
All right, so then we got a follow-up comment from DG, just thought I'd read. It's kind of interesting. So he says, or she, I've actually eaten a ketogenic paleo diet for 5+ years, all grass-fed, organic, no fruit, no grains, legumes, etc. Train 2 times a week, 20-minute high-intensity workouts, get good dark sleep like a baby, yet my cortisol levels are off the ASI chart all day long. My A1C levels are 5.4 and have stubborn fat around the middle. Been on my wits end trying to figure this out. I got a glucometer to see what was going on. It confounds me even more. Sometimes after grass-fed beef and broccoli, greens, peppers mix of veggies, my blood sugar goes up to between 118 and 125. The only way I can keep it below 100 in between meals is to eat something like only eggs. My fasting blood sugar is typically 95 to 106. All this happens when I keep my carb intake well under 50 grams, usually under 30. If you have any thoughts on the direction to go, I'd appreciate it very much. Oh, in case it matters, I'm 56-year-old female, very strong and healthy, 5'7", weighing 135.
I'm guessing potentially like a food allergy with this. Because she sees this elevated blood glucose level with some things, but not with others. So that would be my first place that I would look at. If we have some foods that aren't eliciting this problem, then I would start looking at that as a potential place to look. And also, here again, like if we're talking about this whole thing, if she's training pretty hard, maybe we do need some post-workout carbs in here to prevent the potential cortisol spike from low blood sugar levels.
Yeah, and I would actually be curious to see what her 2 20-minute high-intensity workouts are a week. I would also just be curious on that.
Yeah.
We've seen some folks I know with some pretty significant cortisol stuff where their workouts turned into some basic weight training and walking to see if we could get some movement on their ASI first before we did anything that would look like any type of high intensity training.
Yeah, and I just started reading some of Richard's stuff over at Free the Animal, and he's been playing around with some of Martin's material, playing around with the lean gains approach, and like Martin just has this great orientation on minimize cortisol levels, do some low-level cardio like walking, get your diet dialed in, and lift some heavy weights a couple of times a week if the main focus is leaning out. And I think people ascribe too much benefit to interval training as a means of leaning out and not enough to cortisol management and stuff like that. And so if we have an established pattern here of elevated cortisol levels, definitely, even though it's only 2 20-minute high-intensity workouts a week, that may be too much. It may be too much pasted across a background of some other issues. So I would definitely start playing with some variables, when you're eating, when you're going to bed, food quality, like I mentioned before, potentially some sort of a food intolerance deal that's causing some elevated cortisol levels. And then really reevaluating the need for the high-intensity exercise if the main focus is leaning out and reducing cortisol levels.
Yes. Good. Next, I have a question from Matt. Dear Rob and Andy, totally love the podcast, even though my girlfriend hates me for listening to it in the car with her. Yeah, you might want to stop that. Although helping me with this question might help her to love you as much as I love you, and that's a lot of love. One of our good friends has cystic fibrosis, which is compounded by type 1 diabetes. She's a good student and a brilliant artist. When it comes to taking care of herself, I'm concerned she could do more. She doesn't exercise often due to frequent stints in the hospital and is a carboholic. Muffins, pastries, cereal, and frappuccinos make up the bulk of her diet. That said, she's an army of doctors around here, and I'm less than confident going at her with the full frontal paleo attack. I've read a few studies that suggest that a carb-limited diet are helpful with cystic fibrosis, and I'm sure it would help with the type 1 diabetes, but I hope you can help me point her in the right direction with some scientific empirical data to back it up. It is her life I would be messing with. Thank you.
You're totally spot on with this. Like, there's some good literature floating around out there that carbohydrate restricted diet improves cystic fibrosis outcomes. The deal with cystic fibrosis is you have a chloride pump in the lungs, which isn't functioning properly, and so we get an accumulation of fluid in the lungs. And part of that gets addressed and gets improved when we're not dealing with the elevated insulin levels that typify a high carb diet. And then it would also address a lot of the issues of controlling the type 1 diabetic swings. So, I mean, if this gal wants to see some improvement, not just some improvement, but much better outcomes in her long-term health and life, she should definitely consider doing some tinkering with this. We could try to dig around. I mean, basically, it's looking low-carb diet, cystic fibrosis, and going from there. There's definitely some stuff floating around out there on it.
Yeah, I just threw that into Google, and also paleo diet, cystic fibrosis, and there's a ton of stuff out there. I think, you know, the trick is going to be, convincing her. For some folks, honestly, scientific papers don't make that much of a difference, honestly, because we deal with this all the time in our little lab that we deal with.
Yeah, you know, it's funny even within that, when people so often they come to the website looking for some scientific papers, it really begs the question, do you have enough of a background to understand what it's saying? And like, by all means, give it a shot, see what the abstract says and stuff like that. But then from there, you're still just kind of having faith that people crunched the numbers properly, that they didn't cook the numbers, that they didn't have a research bias and all the rest of that. And this is true even on the low-carb side of this stuff. You know, does Jeff Volek have a research bias and he's trying to cook data? I don't think so. I don't think, anything of the sort. I think he's spot on, but this is where when people want a bunch of, like, scientific validation for this stuff, it's kind of like, okay, do you even have enough understanding to get anything out of it? And if you don't, then just give it a shot. You know, make it easy on everybody. Just give it a shot. Here's the parameters. Grab the quick start guide. Do it for a month. See how you look, feel, and perform. Check your lipid, biomarkers of health and disease before and afterwards, and then we're good to go.
Yes. And finally, Rob, question number 12, last question of the episode, from Saturated Fat. PHAT.
Awesome.
I'm an endurance athlete looking to paleo to help break some plateaus and improve performance. Gone mostly gluten and legume free and dairy's next, but I feel like there's always something more to cut out. I'm not sure I understand it aside from the theoretical, which I don't fully buy. Cavemen never ate this, so you shouldn't. Vinegar, for instance, is not paleo, but has a lot of health benefits, unless you disagree. That's question one about vinegar. Let's just start there, Rob.
Oh, man.
I know why I put it last, bro.
Now we get to play the is it paleo reductionist game, and so we can just, like, wander through a shopping center and, like, is that paleo? Is that paleo? How about that? Is that paleo? And, I like vinegar. It tastes great on salad, and I'm not off-put by the acid-base balance. It makes me want to cry.
So, and I think for saturated fat, I don't know, like, we've talked about this 100 times on the podcast, like, we don't actually sell the argument, cavemen never ate this, so you shouldn't.
To some degree, I have formed the basis of some of my arguments in the past about that, and because of some goading on the part of Matt Lalonde, I've really refined my approach to that and rely less on the evolutionary discordance deal and more on the this is just a problematic food, because just simply because it's evolutionarily novel does not necessarily mean that it's bad. So that's something that I've been more careful to modify my stance on and refine what message I'm putting out there so it's a little more scientifically accurate and credible and all that. So hopefully that helps on that regard.
Yes. So saturated fat goes on to say, so you cut grains, legumes, dairy, and then no white potatoes, which are nightshades, and you should probably cut bell peppers, tomatoes, and eggplant too, although I don't really understand why those are better than potatoes, question two. Then eggs aren't really great either, and fruit isn't good because of the fructose load, and now it's getting pretty restrictive. Why don't you handle question two? Why are things like bell peppers, tomatoes, and eggplant better than potatoes? If they are.
Well, here again, it's like, who are we talking about and what's the level of refinement that we're dealing with here? What the problem is potentially is that the tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants potentially have some gut-irritating lectins in them that may be linked with some autoimmune problems, and a lot of people who have autoimmunity seem to benefit significantly from reducing the consumption of these items. Potatoes seem to be much less problematic so long as you avoid the, interesting enough, the skins seem to be the main repository of some of the more gut-irritating alkaloids and some of the lectins. And eggplants, tomatoes and everything, just the fruiting body itself has some of the problematic items in it. But this is, again, this is for somebody who generally has some autoimmune conditions. So saturated fat is jumping in on this. It's such a level that, you know, trying to have it all figured out before even getting in and doing any of it sounds like.
But. Yeah, and I don't think we actually have really a problem with some nice pastured eggs, assuming you don't have autoimmune problems. I love eggs. I eat six every day.
Yeah, and this, again, the eggs have some lysozyme, which is a gut irritant. And we, again, you know, like particularly with like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, we see the removal of eggs to be additionally beneficial for folks. So this is a situational thing. And so instead of calling it paleo or caveman, because everybody gets all spun out about that, then we'll say for some people with autoimmune conditions or other inflammatory conditions, foods including potatoes, tomatoes, eggplants, and eggs may be problematic. You should experiment with this and see what the heck is going on so that you know what issues you have.
Yes.
And if that still bunches somebody's panties, I just don't know what to tell them.
Don't be angry about your messaging, Rob. Don't be angry today. You're almost done.
Andy's like, keep it together, baby.
The tracks are shaking. We're about to go off. Saturated fat goes on to say, why are nuts still in the mix after we're talking about cutting out eggs? They're obscenely high in omega-6s, full of anti-nutrients, and for those who want to lose weight, are calorically dense and taste way too good. A lot of people, myself included, can put away a jar of almond butter or cashews and not think twice until they feel awful afterwards. My question is, what makes nuts better than legumes or nightshades? What's worse about white potatoes or hummus? It might be basic, but I really still don't get it. Thanks a lot. Got the book on the way and looking forward to checking it out.
Yeah. All of these things can be problematic for the reasons listed. And so we need to figure out who you are, what your needs are, and then make a decision about where these foods fit into your goals. And so for, it sounds like the, you know, main deal, we've got an endurance athlete here. What I'll say is that in general, if we have you eating what is essentially a, if we say paleo diet and that freaks the person out, then we'll say a protein-centric, higher fat, largely, carbohydrate consumption from non-gut irritating items, and we're trying to balance omega-3, omega-6 intake while optimizing micronutrient intake, then we end up with what is also on the other side, what is generally referred to as kind of a paleo-type approach. And there are some caveats to it that you can tweak or refine based on what your needs are and what you individually have going on.
Yeah, and I think for most folks that are starting, unless they have some of the specific conditions you're talking about, things like nightshades and eggs and even nuts, we don't really get too freaked out about.
Right, right. You know, the nuts we've tended to steer our clients away from because they are easily overconsumed, and because we're seeing that the omega-3, omega-6 imbalance is problematic. And frankly, I was seeing a lot of digestive problems with that. And I don't know if it was just from the fat load or from the lectin, you know, anti-nutrient load or what, but over the course of time, we've refined our message to kind of minimize those things. And here again, I delineate all the stuff actually in the book. So possibly after reading the book, most of these questions would have become moot.
Right.
Oddly enough.
Rob Wolf, that is ridiculous. And you know, by the fact of writing a book, you're just actually asking for more questions.
It's true.
If you never told anybody your opinion, you wouldn't get questions, actually.
Well, and you know, the funny thing is, this is a massively consistent theme. When we were in Houston, a very sweet woman came up to me. We stopped by Irwan's MoveNAC clinic he had going on, and she said, "Hey, I have some questions." And she started laying all these questions on me, and I have these some concerns about how I implement this and how do you do it. And I just looked at her and I said, "You haven't read the book yet, have you?" And she was just like, "No." And I said, "So why are you getting all worked up about what your family's going to do and your concerns about implementation and the whole thing, and you haven't even read it? Like, why are you heading into this with a bunch of questions and concerns instead of just reading the book and seeing what comes out of that experience?" And she was a little flabbergasted, I think, at the end of it. But there's a remarkable number of people who right on the edge of picking up the book, opening it and reading it, and I feel like I do a decent job of covering a bunch of this stuff, you know, like laying out, do this for autoimmunity, do this for general stuff, you know, and kind of delineating all that. But right before the person picks up the book to read it, then they start rattling off this litany of questions about it. And it's like, dude, just give the book a shot first, and then we'll talk turkey after that and see if we didn't answer a few of those questions and put some stuff into context.
And with that, Rob Wolf, that is the end of episode 54, my friend. An hour and 11 minutes.
Cool.
So we will see you next week, and you're in town for like a whole month, so no concerns.
Yeah, and we're doing a Tim Ferriss podcast here pretty soon. I'm not sure exactly what day that will run, but like early December we'll be hitting that. So keep your eyes open for that.
Tim Ferriss. What's his new book called, Rob? Do you know?
The 4-Hour Body.
Nice. The 4-Hour Body. That's a conveniently similar title to the 4-Hour Work Week. Shocking.
There's some branding going on there.
I'm shocked coming from Tim. So yeah. Anyway, man, enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Andy.
See you, Rob.